It is a beautiful, gray, rainy day. The perfect kind of weather for talking about books. And I have some room temperature tea. I tend to forget about my tea until it gets to room temperature. But the book we're going to talk about, the scout notes we're going to do this week, is How to Listen to Jazz by Ted Gioia. This is the book that I alluded to last episode when I was talking about Agatha Christie and I mentioned the innovations of Louis Armstrong. And I said that I wasn't going to name the book. This is the book that I was referring to. Ted Gioia has a Substack that I follow called The Honest Broker. I actually picked up this book completely independent of that fact. I'd been listening to a lot of audiobooks on Spotify because it's now included with your monthly subscription. You get 15 hours of audiobook, which for someone who goes through as much audiobook as me, it's a great deal. Anyways, I'm starting to sound like a Spotify ad. I was flipping through there, you know, where it suggests things for you to listen to, and How to Listen to Jazz was there, and I clicked it and started listening to it. And then once I started liking it, that's when I looked and saw, oh, this is written by Ted Gioia. Weird. I follow him on Substack. And actually, this is a big week for Ted when it comes to my particular Substack, because in the newsletter that I put out this week, I also made reference to one of the things that he wrote on his Substack back in October about his 12 problems, the 12 problems that he frames his life through. In particular, the reason that this was appealing to me is because lately I've been listening to a lot of jazz. I'm not a newbie to jazz. When I was in high school, I really got into the Beat movement and Jack Kerouac and Allen Ginsberg and William Burroughs. And I say got into it like I got out of it. I'm still in it. But that's back when it started. And it's kind of hard to get into the Beat generation without also learning a little bit about jazz. So jazz has been something that I've had, I don't want to say a passing interest, but a mild interest in for a very long time. I just never really, how could I say this? I never really educated myself on jazz. I never committed myself to learning about jazz. I just knew a few things, and that was good. So lately, mainly because I picked up The Beat Reader, which is the book that got me into the Beat generation in high school. It was assigned in a class. I did a class about counterculture. That book pretty much changed the course of my life in many ways, but we don't need to talk about that book until maybe we talk about it on the show. But I had picked that book up recently, and I decided, hey, let's travel back down this road again and see if anything sparks for me. And to do it, I decided, I should listen to jazz while I'm doing it. And ever since that night, which was about maybe 2 months ago at the most, ever since then, I've been listening to at least a jazz album, maybe at least every 2 or 3 days. So while I still consider myself a unknowledgeable jazz listener, I do still love jazz. But the thing for me has always been the problem of recognition. To some degree, I could say this about classical music. I could say this about any sort of instrumental music. Will I ever reach the point where you put on the first song of Kinda Blue from Miles Davis and I go, ah, we're listening to Kinda Blue. I know what album we're listening to. Or I remember the song title. Will I ever get to that point? Now, I put things on and I recognize them. I'm like, I know this. But if you played it, I probably wouldn't be able to tell you, with the exception of maybe some Coltrane. So what that tells me is that even though it seems really difficult to get to that point with instrumental music, it's not impossible. Obviously, it's not impossible because people like Ted Gioia can do it. You know, so people have done it. It's just it's a matter of, to some degree, impatience. It's also a matter of not putting enough time into it. You have to listen to a lot of jazz to be able to get to that point. So when I saw this, I was pretty attracted to it and thought, yeah, that's a good book for right now. Like, teach me a little bit more about jazz. Teach me how to listen to jazz. And that's pretty much what he accomplishes with this book. It's a nice book to pick up to introduce people to jazz, but also somebody in my position. And I also imagine to some degree, if you love jazz, even reading this is enjoyable because you love jazz. But essentially, it boils down to two sections of the book. The first section is where he talks more about the philosophy of jazz. What is jazz? How do we think about jazz? And what kind of things in the sound should we be listening to? Like syncopation is a big one. And then the second half is more like recommending artists and albums, and very, very fleetingly, because of that, going through sort of a history of jazz. Very fleetingly. Now, like I said, I'm not a complete noob when it comes to jazz. The reason I would recognize probably Coltrane is because the first jazz album that I ever owned was actually not an album. It was a cassette, first of all. So now I'm giving you a sense of my age. And it was a cheap compilation. Now, I don't know if people who really have only experienced streaming music in their lives know what these things were. They used to do it with tapes. They used to do it with CDs, where they would kind of buy the rights to lesser-known versions of songs and then just kind of throw them all together on these compilations, you know, like Gold Edition, or come up with some kind of name for it. And that's what this was. It was probably something I got. I either got it in a bargain bin or I bought it on the ferry when I was in Europe, because I bought a lot of random things in the duty-free shops on the ferry, a lot of random albums, an acoustic Rolling Stones album, which was actually pretty good. I think it was called Stripped or something. But that album, I don't even know what the name of it was. I don't have it anymore. I tracked it down one point a couple years ago, but forgot again because it was not a very memorable name. But it was essentially a live compilation. Normally your live albums are one performance. You know, it was this show when we played this song, and the next we played this song. This was like live performances from many different things. But it was great. And it was the thing that really, I think one of the things that draws me to jazz, if I were to put it number one, tends to be the drums. And I always tell people, if in another life, I think it's quite possible I was a jazz drummer. And it doesn't mean that all I listen to is the drums, but just something about the drums. And it comes from this album. There's some fantastic drumming on this, some of the songs in this compilation. And I think that's where my interest in jazz drumming started. When I was in my 20s, all the way into my early 30s, there was an Irish pub that I would hang out with. Me and my friends, we would hang out at this place. And there was an outdoor patio in front of the place that we used to always sit on. And one night a week, they would always have a jazz band, a live jazz band, you know, just an amateur live jazz band. But in that group, the drummer was pretty good. I think the drummer was pretty good. And the way that this patio was set up was between the patio and the inside of the pub were these glass paneled doors. And the drummer was always set up right in front of that glass panel door. And he would always open the door behind him so he can get some airflow, because, you know, obviously he's working up more of a sweat than the horn players. So because of that, I heard the drums more. So I think those two things is what really got me fascinated with syncopated drum playing, I guess, if you take it to its basics. And then in turn, because that John Coltrane compilation was a big deal for me, I got into John Coltrane. So my jazz for a while, all my jazz knowledge was Coltrane. And the album for me with him has always been A Love Supreme. I don't know why. Many people say it's not necessarily his best album. It's one of his best, but I think there are arguments for the other ones. But this one is always connected with me. In fact, I have it on vinyl in the other room. Other albums that were a big deal to me that come to mind that I love: Miles Davis, Bitches Brew, Sonny Rollins, The Bridge, Ornette Coleman, The Shape of Jazz to Come. And then randomly I found this one about a year, maybe 2 years ago, Clifford Brown and Max Roach. It's the artist and also the name of the album. Randomly found that. Those five come to mind. But other than A Love Supreme, I might not be able to tell you what we're listening to if you put those on, to reiterate my point from earlier. just because I haven't spent enough time with them. Actually, I think I probably would recognize Bitches Brew because it's pretty unique. So when it comes to listening, what are some of the interesting things that Joya recommends? Well, one of the things that stood out to me that I thought was a really interesting idea, and it took me a while to actually figure out what was interesting about it. But he says that he recommends that you listen to second-rate jazz artists as a way of learning to appreciate what the great artists are accomplishing. And I think in some way this relates to the thing about Louis Armstrong and innovation, where it's hard to recognize all the innovations of Louis Armstrong because everything that came after him was influenced by that. So we don't notice how innovative what he's doing is. And I think to some degree, if you don't know jazz on an intimate level, you can't really appreciate what's going on in the music until you hear somebody doing the same thing less well. You know, for example, the song "A Love Supreme," maybe not the best example because there's voice chanting in it, but you hear Coltrane do it, maybe all you notice is the voice chanting, "A Love Supreme, A Love Supreme," over and over again. Maybe that's all you get out of it. But then if you go somewhere and you see like a high school band, nothing against high school bands, but they're not, you know, they're not John Coltrane and his band. You hear them do that song. It's a, you know, maybe it's good, but it's not as good. That gap between those two things, he said, is where you start to really understand and appreciate what's going on in jazz. And I think that's an interesting idea because we often avoid what we would call quote unquote inferior because we assume that, you know, because something is less good, maybe is a better way than saying inferior. Something is less good that has less to teach us or that it doesn't have anything to teach us. So in a way, this reiterates my point from the last episode about And Then There Were None, where I talked about snobbery, talked about highbrow and lowbrow and how I try to mix it up with the books here. Because I really believe that lowbrow books, midbrow books, they have as much to teach us as the highbrow ones do. Popular books are as valuable to me as literature. Literature, you know, high literature. Shakespeare, Alexander Pope, stuff like that. Or you know, 1980s B, C, D grade or horror films, you know, the kind that they used to, they put the amazing covers on and if you're old enough, you'd see them in a video store back when we used to rent VHS. These kind of movies, not high art, but I feel like they have as much to teach as the Criterion Collection does. And in fact, if you were in my house, you would see that when it comes time to watch movies, the majority of the time, I'm either going to Tubi and watching a B, C, D grade VHS movie, or I'm going to something like the Criterion Collection or Mubi, M-U-B-I, and watching some great art house or great foreign film, because to me, they're equal. I mean, even Baywatch, I think, has something to teach us. I went back and watched Baywatch, half of Baywatch. I think about, was it 2 years ago? Yeah, I think it was 2 years ago. And I was enjoying the hell out of it. And the reason I was enjoying the hell out of it is because it was fun in a way that so much stuff isn't now. Everything is so concerned with imposing a moral perspective upon us that oftentimes that's more important than making a good TV show or a good book or a good movie. And it's just boring and you feel like you're being condescended to. Whereas Baywatch is kind of like, yeah, that lady just had a baby in 4 seconds because yeah, that's real. And they just don't care because it's about being entertaining and not being realistic. And that in itself is a lesson to learn about creating things. You've got to be, there has to be a level of enjoyment to it as well. Highbrow, lowbrow. That's what lowbrow can teach us often, is how to enjoy things and to not take things too seriously. One of the other things that Ted Joya says about jazz that really resonates with me is that improvisation is the one part of jazz that defies intellectualizing. And to say that another way, if you were to take jazz as people often do in a university environment and dissect it and analyze it, the one thing you're going to have trouble intellectualizing and analyzing in the to the same degree is the improvisation, the things that the artist comes up with in the moment. You can mathematically reason syncopation and tempo, and you can talk about scales, and you can talk about tonality and atonality, but the improvisation is hard to intellectualize because improvisation is more about psychology, the psychology of the person playing it, than it is about mathematics, numbers, scales. For example, Thelonious Monk, if you go listen to Thelonious Monk, Thelonious's Blues is probably a really good example. The only reason I was able to pull that out of my hat is because I listened to this the other night. He's playing the piano. I don't remember if it's the first or the second track, maybe even the third, beginning of the album. You notice, first of all, his timing's a little different, a little weird. He's not always exactly where he should be, theoretically, you know, if we're talking about it mathematically, if a machine was doing it. But he also plays wrong notes, quote-unquote wrong notes. And it's not because he doesn't know scales and he doesn't know the right notes. It's because he's playing on gut. He's improvising, and he's improvising on gut. And sometimes that involves atonality, breaking out of the key, breaking the rules. And one of the things also that Gioia mentions in the book is that players, often jazz players, but this also I think applies to, in my experience, guitar players, they become so skilled at playing other people's music. Piano players, this is a great example. Piano players, they learn all of Beethoven, they learn all of Mozart, and they can play it picture perfect. But they're so skilled at other people's work that they never actually discover their own voice. So everything they do is some form of mimicry. And what I'm reminded of right now actually is Data from Star Trek The Next Generation. He's an android. He doesn't have emotion, but he learns how to become a very technically beautiful violin player. The way he becomes a beautiful violin player is that instead of playing like one player, he actually picks parts from other players and mixes them together and makes his own unique voice. This is how almost all music innovation happens. Rock and roll is a mix of things. Great artists are a mix of things. How many Beatles songs are, you know, like, what is that? We call it rock, but is it really rock? You know, sometimes they're going back to like vaudeville. That's unique voice. It's not about technical skill. It's not about the intellectualizing. It's not about the highbrow. In that case, maybe it's just maybe gut and improvisation and instinct are about midbrow. You're balancing in there between your emotions and your mind. Another suggestion he gives that I'm going to take to heart is that in order to get into modern jazz, I think when he says modern jazz, what he's referring to is not big band stuff, not swing stuff, not Count Basie or Duke Ellington, but Coltrane, Miles Davis, that form of modern jazz where jazz gets more complicated. He suggests that the way to get into that is to actually learn to sing or hum along to the music, try to hum the melodies that the musicians are playing. And in doing that, you'll actually begin to also, again, appreciate the complexities of what's going on. I think that's an interesting example. It also reminds me of something I saw a long time ago of Carlos Santana, where he is talking about how guitar licks are like they're like vocalizations, except that the words are just in the guitar player's head. So he plays a little riff, like it's saying, guitar player, guitar player, guitar player. And that's how he thinks about the little parts that he plays on the guitar, like he's singing. Most of that stuff is the beginning half of the book. And then the second half is when we get into, as I mentioned before, where he's talking about artists, specific artists. He's telling you what's interesting to pay attention to when listening to artists like Coltrane, Miles Davis, so forth. And he's going to tell you what albums he thinks that you should check out to get into that artist. So the moment I heard this stuff, I was like, oh, yeah, this is awesome, but this tells me I need to buy this book. This is a book that needs to be on a shelf and something you can pull down and reference. And it got me actually thinking about the idea of what defines a book to the degree where I go, I need to physically own that. And in this case, like I said, it's something I want to reference. I want to use it as a tutor. You know, I'm going to listen to some jazz right now. Let's check out some jazz I haven't listened to. Let's listen to an album that I haven't listened to. Let's see what sentence or two he says about that album so I can keep that in mind when I sit down to listen to that. And I think that is the testament to the power a book can have. It's a weight that comes with it by it becoming a physical object. It's hard to explain. I devoured this book. Let's start there. Like, I went through this book pretty fast because I was into the subject and I was just learning and I was just really fascinated with what he had to say about it. But as I mentioned, Ted has a Substack, and I started to think about near the end of the book, I started to ask myself, if he had, instead of this being chapters, what if he had broken this up and these were released on his Substack? Would I feel the same way about it? Same exact information. Would I feel the same way about it? And the answer was no. And that's an interesting thing to think about. Obviously, I'm not opposed to Substack because Substack is my main creative outlet. But there is something different. I think that's why I'm so tied to the newsletter format as opposed to writing articles on Substack. Because the newsletter is more personal and it just, I don't want to say it's more disposable, but it's more consumable in that manner. Whereas I feel like if you're presenting something, you're presenting ideas, you're presenting philosophies, you're presenting arguments, it does better service to those things if you can put them into a book, because something about the process, even in audiobook format, something about the process of them being packaged in a book in the context of each other instead of being released separately, something about that gives it weight. I don't know what that is. That's something that maybe over time as we go through this, we go through more and more books, maybe we'll begin to understand that. But something that I wanted to point out, and maybe you guys can keep that in mind as well. And maybe you have some theories too, which is one of the great things about Substack. If you actually go over to the website, you can leave comments and we can actually have a conversation. So anyways, those are my thoughts on how to listen to jazz. The fact that I said that I want to physically own it should tell you that I like the book. And I mentioned my Substack. Well, while we're talking about it, you should go over there and become a paid subscriber, because as I've mentioned in every episode so far, that's how you will get access to the deep dive episodes, which we have one coming up. I'm hoping maybe I can get it done this week, but it depends how this week goes. But the book will be The Creative Act by Rick Rubin. It's in front of me right now. I have my hands physically touching it. I don't know if you can hear that scratch sound, but that was me scratching the cover. So go over there, become a paid subscriber so you have access to that. It's going to be longer than these little 20, 30 minute episodes. I don't know how long, but a lot longer. You can also subscribe there. Same exact place, creativeisolation.substack.com, and get the newsletter that I just mentioned, which is, it's about my creative process mostly, but other things leak into there. But it's fun. I keep telling people it's a fun thing. They don't get it. I'm like, it's supposed to be, and what I said about Baywatch, it's supposed to be something enjoyable. It's not something for you to take too seriously. And actually, also this week, I started a second podcast. Yeah, I'm crazy. And it's on Creative Isolation too. This is really only a podcast. This is a super niche podcast. This is really only for the nerdiest of the nerds out there. The people that want to actually hear me talk about technical processes of dealing with applications, how I'm working with information within the applications and so forth like that. It's just something I had to get out. It's something that is valuable to me. And I know a very small subset of people are interested in it as well. So it's for them. It's not for all of you, but it is there if you want to check it out. I will not be surprised, nor will I be hurt if it bores you. Because as I said, super niche, super technical. And then lastly, if you want to hear what it sounds like when I try to write fiction, check out my fiction project, The Thing That Devours Everything, which is on a separate Substack, thingthatdevours.substack.com. As always, links are in the description of the episode, as well as a link to go check out this book from Ted Goya, and also a link to his Substack. Go check out his Substack. It's good stuff. All right. We'll talk soon. I am out of here. Go read a book.